we have a very negative image of the city in most of our arts. Our literature has been one that denounces the anonymity and alienness and disorienting quality of the city. When people do paint the city, it's often without people in it, or it's things like Central Park in the city, or the pond, or the river running through Philadelphia.
Right.
People have an urge out from the city toward nature. For one thing, we never had a sacred city, a center of a national cult, which is what most other civilizations have had.
Historian Gary Wills of Northwestern University, along with New York Times correspondent Paul Goldberger and Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke, he's here to talk about the changing American city. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Ford Foundation. Additional in-kind support for this program comes from Time Warner Cablevision. Ours is a time of rapid globalization of the economy, dramatic changes in population patterns, and deep social and political transition. Against that backdrop, the National Humanities Center recently undertook a fresh examination of the role of the city in American society. This effort took the form of a conference entitled The Changing American City and was part of the center's ongoing American Issues Forum. First on Soundings this week, historian Gary Wills discusses the city in the American imagination. After that, New York Times correspondent Paul Goldberger will address the question, is there still a reason for cities? Finally, Kurt Schmoke will be here to comment on the future of the city in American society. We begin with the city in the American imagination. Here is historian Gary Wills.
In America, we came with the idea that we are going to a kind of unspoiled continent, and we're going to live close to the earth, and we're not going to repeat the errors of Europe and have these big, crowded, disease-ridden cities. So even before we had major cities, there were people attacking them, Thomas Jefferson foremost among them.
Right.
We never thought that we would have a Jerusalem, a high place that we go to for our sacred life. Our temples, our churches, our shrines have largely been nature. We've had a cult of the Hudson River Valley and Yosemite Park and Monument Valley and all these kind of sacred forests. We want to be close to the land, and we don't feel that we are really free unless we are able to breathe some large space.
Yet it is possible to argue that our artists, our novelists, our poets, you mentioned jazz as a principal mm-hmm. expression of life in the city, have great affection, abiding love for the city. Should we break that down into a love-hate kind of thing, or is that the artist being the rebel again?
Well, artists have gone to the cities primarily because that's where publishing takes place.
Uh-huh. That's where we're talking about money, huh?
Sure, it's the market. That's where agents are, and that's where studios are, where artists mm-hmm. can peddle their works.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the ones who become successful then go off to the countryside, upstate,
well,
or wherever.
Well, isn't it possible to argue that cities are necessary for what we call our American educational system, whether we want to praise it or damn it? The education of Americans wouldn't have occurred without the models that we have in the cities. Can we find something good to say on that score?
Well, I can find a lot that's good to say. It's not reflected much in our literature or art, uh-huh. and it should be, probably. I, for one, am a city person. I don't ever want to be away from a city.
Right.
I like museums and symphony orchestras and that kind of cultural life that you can't get anywhere else. But that is not a love that has had a very strong or forceful expression in the arts or in literature certainly not in film.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they are so bad, why is it that they persist?
We need them. There's no getting around them.
Right.
Last night we heard at this conference that people who flee to the suburbs and don't like the cities nonetheless want to use airports, want to use highways, want to use other things that wouldn't be there except for the fact that a city grew up with these complex modern means of communication and transportation that you wouldn't have anywhere else. You can't go out into a farm and they'll build you your own little airport and your own little radio station and that kind of thing. So you have to go to the city to get those things. But people resent having to do that and never seem to find a way of expressing in a positive way what the city is doing for them.
Mr. Wills, you mentioned in your presentation the art of an artist named Kenyon Cox. Tell me about that. Why is that representative? You seem to argue that that is a sort of core image of our cities.
Yes. Well, Kenyon Cox was a muralist who was very popular in the early years of this century, and he did a great deal of the work inside our national capital and in other public edifices all around the country, including one very ambitious triptych that he did in the Wisconsin state capital, in the legislative chamber there at a time when Wisconsin was kind of the leader of progressive thought, celebrating the ongoing construction of the Panama Canal, in which Columbia, the goddess of America, is presiding over the marriage of the Pacific and the Atlantic through the Isthmus of Panama. And when the European people come to the wedding with gifts, England brings law, Germany brings learning, France brings art, Columbia puts her spear up and kind of seals them off and accepts their gifts only with great reluctance, whereas her hand is stretched out to the West to spread light to the Native Americans, to Polynesians in the South Sea Islands, to blinkered and blinded pagans in Far East. Our attitude is that we've had enough of Europe. We've taken what we wanted. We'll cope. But now we are giving our richness out toward the West. And the West is totally without towns in this picture. Even though it's a 20th century picture, the West is presented still as virgin territory, the kind of place where we are always lighting out for the territory, where we are always getting close to nature by leaving behind corrupt Europe, the East, the cities.
Well, is it possible to argue that the cities are, in fact, if not our last frontier, that they should be, to put the best spin on things, that they should be our last frontier?
Oh, I think so. I think that, for instance, isn't it absurd that we have in the past sent Peace Corps people around the world to help with problems of poverty and disease and education in other countries? In our own inner cities, we don't send young people, volunteers, money, help to the fellow Americans who are dying of crack and all kinds of social afflictions. Sure, that should be our frontier. That should be our workplace.
Would you say, Mr. Wills, that there is a city or a kind of city that exists in the United States that we can take as a model for what cities should be doing? This is a big issue. You don't want to name names and play favorites, but you must have some sense of that.
No, there's not one city. Various cities are doing various things. There are all kinds of community programs, building programs, park programs. One of the most valuable things that it was made into a laughingstock by the Republicans is midnight basketball. My son plays basketball. He's a young businessman, but he was a very good athlete, and he plays on a team with largely black players in the inner city. And he tells me that midnight basketball is a place where people go when it's hot in the summer night. People don't have air conditioning. Instead of sitting on tenement stoops, instead of going out and getting into fights, they go to these games. Not only the players, but their family. The people come and cheer on. It created a cultural expression of community. And for the Republicans to mock this as an example of liberal stupidity is an amazing shows an amazing lack of knowledge of what's going on in the cities.
Well, that's the fun thing about stereotypes. We can inflate them, we can trivialize them, we can do with them what we want. Gary Wills, where do you think the leadership is going to come from? Do we have to talk in partisan terms? Do we have to have ideological coalitions and divides when we speak of the health and the growth of our cities? What about citizens? I mean, where is their role in all of this?
Well, citizens are voters, and if they want to vote their interests, they can sabotage almost anything to help the cities. Politicians can only appeal to citizens if they are willing to follow and to pay out some tax money to do things with the city out of a sense of obligation to what they've done for us. Unfortunately, it's very easy for politicians to appeal simply to momentary selfishness and lose track of how important the cities were. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy now when we have interstate highways to forget that the trains ran into the cities, that the place where you gathered and picked people up was there, not at airports stranded out in large space because they needed to land. They needed to land in. But the cities that grew up out of that and have now been bypassed are themselves the seed out of which the airports came and the highways came and all the other things that the suburbanites use. Now, how you get them to acknowledge that responsibility, that indebtedness, is a challenge to every politician who wants to be elected by them. It's very hard, and it takes a great deal of creativity on their part.
Gary Wills teaches at Northwestern University. His book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, won the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is entitled Certain Trumpets. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with an overview of a recent conference at the center entitled The Changing American City. From the city in the American imagination, we turn now to one of the conference's central questions. Is there still a reason for cities? Here is Paul Goldberger, chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times.
We're not fundamentally an urban culture.
Right.
We believe in movement, in change, in the frontier, in the open road, in always new turf all the time.
Walt Whitman's poetry.
Absolutely. And the city represents permanence. The city represents staying in one place and building a kind of monument to that place.
Right.
In a way that runs against the American grain. And I think we built great cities not because we loved the idea of cities so much as because economically that's how business was done and that's how one did things. That's how you traded. That's how you did commerce. That's how you did banking. That's how you did everything. Now it's no longer the case. All these commercial enterprises can happen more or less any way people choose.
Mm-hmm.
So we're left with the question of who is left in our cities. Right now, most major cities have essentially two very different income groups. The poor, who couldn't afford to pick up and go out to the suburbs or to some new community somewhere, and the very rich, who were able to skim off the top the greatest of urban experiences and live in, unfortunately, often extreme isolation from the poor. I question whether our older central cities will ever have the range of incomes and the solid middle class that they once did.
Hmm.
I don't think that will happen again, and I think in many ways the most sensible thing to do is what was done in Indianapolis, which is to just redefine the city with a broader circle and call the suburbs and the city, the whole region, just call it the city now,
mm-hmm.
and thus therefore bring within the governance group of the city voters of a much greater income range and diversity and so forth.
Well, let me stop you for a moment. Without, if you want to name names, you certainly may. If you want to reveal your politics, your ideological bents, you may do that. Where is the leadership going to come from? Are we talking about citizens? Are we talking about voluntary groups? Are we talking about politicians? The arts councils?
Okay,
my goodness,
we're talking about a lot of different things in terms of city leadership right now. What we're definitely not talking about is Washington, which seems to be eager to not only continue, but expand and intensify the anti-urban policy that is all too traditional in this country.
Yeah,
really.
Cities crystallize our worst fears.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
They do. Again, because they are not believed to be truly American.
Mm-hmm.
Real Americans are out on the frontier, which may be described as driving your minivan along the interstate,
right.
But that's still a certain kind of frontier. I think the leadership is going to come in all kinds of directions. First, we do see a growing community development movement in all kinds of cities, a growing sense of neighborhood consciousness, a growing commitment to the permanence of communities on all levels in all cities. And a lot of that is grassroots leadership. And that's continuing to strengthen all over.
Let's pursue another line that you brought up, Paul Goldberger, in your presentation at the American Issues Forum, and that is the distinctions, the continuities that bind and separate what we call the public and the private. You say that our public life now exists in private, in automobiles, little steel cages. Yes. We drive up and down freeways, or we go to places that have, as we noted a moment ago, sort of pseudo-recreations of what used to be our public spaces.
That's exactly right.
Where is the shared experience of cities headed?
Well, it's been heading in the last generation more and more toward the private realm. The public realm has become a private realm of a sort. People don't shop along real streets anymore. Mm-hmm. They shop in malls. In the city, they go into atriums as public space. Parks are increasingly taken over by private plazas and things like that. Or in some cases, I know in New York, Bryant Park behind the public library was actually turned over to a private development corporation which leases it from the city and which took care of restoring it and now runs it as a private concession, the entire park. They did a wonderful job, by the way, and restored it beautifully, drove out the drug dealers. It's a healthy, safe, beautiful park. The city was incapable of doing it. It's probably better this way than the other way. Yet, what a sad commentary that the city can't do it itself. We see this privatization of the public realm going on all over today. We see it in the suburbs, too. We see it in private gated communities with private roads, where the entire community is one vast piece of private property.
And if you're inside, it's okay. If you're outside, then you have, what, a racial or a class issue at work?
Well, what we see is greater and greater fragmentation and separation.
Right.
And the urban ideal is about diversity and coming together. And what we're doing, it seems to me, is moving in the opposite direction, toward greater fragmentation, toward greater separation, toward greater fear of each other, and so forth. There's a paradox in all of this, I think, by the way, which no one seems to recognize or comment much on, which is that one of the other things that's so extraordinary about urban life is that for all that it is public in the best sense, streets are public places, civic squares, a sense of community life and a sense of shared commitment to a place, it's also private in that it confers a certain kind of anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one can lead a more private life in the middle of the teeming millions of New York than one can live in a small village where everybody knows your business.
Well, that's one of the great themes of American literature.
Yes,
get to the city to find oneself.
That's right, precisely. Yeah. And that's still the case. Cities still are able to confer that on those who wish it.
And so that's something that we want to preserve.
I think it's something we very much want to preserve.
Uh-huh.
It's not something we're in danger of losing particularly, except we're in danger of no longer remembering it and seeing it as a value. That's the difference. We're beginning to get a memory. We're beginning to see ourselves as a culture positioned in time much more than think only in the present.
After all, the country's only a couple of hundred years old,
right.
Huh?
And most of us are a tad younger as individuals, and yet we're beginning to have some inherited sense of being part of a larger continuum of time.
Right.
And we care a little more about the past. We're a little less of a disposable culture than we once were. In the 50s, we viewed all resources, particularly American ones, as infinite. Uh-huh. History would belong to somebody else. Old places were for Europe. You could go visit them like one might go to Disneyland.
Sure.
Our cities were going to be new and different, and we would rebuild them every 20 minutes. It didn't matter. We could always make it bigger and better, and who cares what you throw away to get to that point. Now we're much more protective of our resources. We know they're not infinite, and we know that one of the resources that we treasure most, that is the most fragile in some ways, is a sense of the past and what we've had before. Thus, the historic preservation movement, the landmarks movement that has grown tremendously in the last few years in America.
This itself contains a certain irony, as I remember what you had to say. Why the reason for the historic trusts is what?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, the good reason is what I've just said, a more mature attitude about our culture's past and recognizing that we not only have a valid past, but that by preserving it and understanding it, it enriches the present in a whole different way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the good reason. The bad reason is that very often we struggle to hold on to what's here because not because we love it so much, but because we're terrified of what might replace it.
Right.
And because architecture has been, unfortunately, in the last couple of generations, so much modern architecture has been so lousy that, what could be worse than whatever will go in the place of that old house or church or school or what have you?
Paul Goldberger is chief cultural correspondent for the New York Times. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with an overview of a recent conference at the center entitled The Changing American City. After hearing from Gary Wills about the city in the American imagination and from Paul Goldberger about reasons for cities today, we turn now to the comments of Kurt Schmoak, mayor of Baltimore, Maryland. To conclude Soundings this week, Kurt Schmoak talks about his own city and prospects for the city in American society.
It is classic to view America's cities these days as a tale of two cities. I mean, you go to some of our areas and see all these beautiful things that are occurring, like in our city with the beautiful waterfront development, things of that nature. But then you move a couple of miles away from the waterfront and you see some of the worst social conditions. In fact, there are some areas of Baltimore that look more like third world countries than a product of American democracy. And the reason is that far too many cities have been locked into the old way of financing cities, that is, by the property taxes being the number one contributor to your general fund.
So what's the answer?
Well, it really is more of a tax sharing. It's more of the creation of intervention strategies. Like at the state level, we have something called a disparity grant, which is like a federal block grant program, which allows the governor to provide to low-wealth jurisdictions some extra money in order to improve government operations. If you're in a state where you have a good relationship with your state government, that helps. Far too many of our cities are in states in which there's a hostile relationship with the state capital, and that's when you have really a lot of problems.
Well, now, in the meantime, I mean, you politicians are always looking to the horizon and trying to figure out where the money's going to come from.
Right.
But in the meantime, you take the measure of urban problems in places like Baltimore, drugs, the apparent decline of American education, AIDS in
right.
the city. I heard you say that the leading cause of death
for
young people,
that's right,
18 to 35 or whatever,
right.
is AIDS. How in the world do you figure out where to put the priorities and where to begin to solve the problems?
Well, it's a tough call. I mean, for me, it has been in education. It seems to me that people who have a good education have the best opportunity of making choices in their lives, who they're able to open up opportunities for themselves. And so as you look at all those tough problems, and of course one of the most pressing each day is crime and just a sense of safety. So for me, education and public safety have been the top priorities. There are many others who would argue that economic development investments and things of that nature should be the leaders, but you can't do everything. And
mm-hmm.
if you try to do everything, you're going to end up just being mediocre.
What about the issue of race? Is that a word that figures very large in your vocabulary?
Yeah, it's one of those most difficult problems. Secretary Cisneros has talked about the importance of race as an issue in terms of the viability of cities. David Rusk, former mayor of Albuquerque, in his book has also indicated that that is a major consideration. For me, I can see it day to day. That race is still an important issue. Baltimore's public schools, for example, are almost totally resegregated.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at our system since 1954, when it was integrated, it is now about 80% African American, and in the high schools, it's an even higher percentage. But then you look just over the border at our surrounding county, and that county is about 85 or 80% white. The city is about 60% black.
Was it an issue, Mayor Schmoak, when you got yourself elected? Here you're in your second term. I mean, in what way
yeah.
do you sort of run with the race issue or avoid it?
Yeah. Well, in my first election, I was running for state's attorney. I ran against a white incumbent. And race was an issue, but it didn't become the issue. We talked mostly about crime and drugs and tried to stay away from race as a factor. But if you look at the resulting votes, you could see that without either of us making an appeal based on race, the votes came down on a fault line that was almost racial in its definition. This year, I will be running against a person, a white female, who's challenging me, and we are working very hard to try to keep race as the dominant issue, though we know it will be an issue. It's an issue primarily, not because of the makeup, the racial makeup of the city, but in the last year or so, the debate about race on the national level has taken a decidedly more negative turn. Discussion about affirmative action, the contract with America, appears on its face more hostile to the cities. So that sets a backdrop in which racial sensitivities are heightened, mm-hmm. and I think that's why race is going to be more of an issue this time than maybe before.
Kurt Schmoke is mayor of Baltimore, Maryland. He spoke at a recent conference at the National Humanities Center entitled The Changing American City. The Changing American City was part of the center's American Issues Forum, a series of gatherings designed to explore ideas of national consequence that have figured in the work of historian John Hope Franklin. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Ford Foundation. Additional in-kind support for the American Issues Forum came from Time Warner Cablevision. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were historian Gary Wills of Northwestern University, New York Times correspondent Paul Goldberger, and Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke. All three participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center entitled The Changing American City. Cassette tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 793. That's $10, program number 793. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, novelist Anderson Farrell and filmmaker Mackie Alston. Anderson Farrell will be here to read from and talk about his new book, Home for the Day. Mackie Alston will discuss Family Name, his new documentary film about race and memory. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.